The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is Friday, March 25th, 2011. I want to thank the members and the audience for getting up so early in the morning. We thought that as we pick this date and time, that it might be better than coming in here on a Saturday. And so if we focus on our work, we won't have to have any extended hours today. Senator Hahn, you have Senate File 1017 before us. We will be trying to limit our discussion and give both sides to this issue a fair hearing with equal time. Senator Hahn, you have the floor. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I apologize for being the cause of an early morning committee meeting. I appreciate your consideration. And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'd like to offer the A5 amendment as an author's amendment. It is a delete all, and I believe that that is the amendment you have in your packet. So I'd like to offer that, and I don't know what the process is, if you have to have a committee member do that for me, but I would like to offer that.
Senator Hahn, Senator Newman will offer the A5 amendment as an author's amendment.
I do indeed, Mr. Chairman.
And this is an author's amendment. All those in favor?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Latz.
Thank you. Is this the first committee that this bill has come before?
Yes.
It hasn't been heard
yes,
in Health
is.
And Human Services?
That's correct. It'll be going to Health and Human Services after this.
Okay. But it originated here?
Yes.
Really? Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, we do have language that is not identical to what we're talking about here that is included in the Health and Human Services bill, but in the course of presenting that, we indicated that was a placeholder anticipating a hearing in Judiciary before that language would be finalized.
All right.
So this bill has not been heard in our committee, but we do have language in our omnibus bill that
okay.
is similar.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. Senator Newman renews his motion introducing the A5 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This amendment pertains to two pieces of policy and changing current practice. The first part of the bill, sections 1 through section 5, I believe, pertains to the collection and retention of DNA blood samples that are collected as a result of infant screening. And it is my intent with this amendment not to interfere with the process in the good of screening that occurs at the time of shortly after birth, where a sample is taken and used to determine if there are things that need to be addressed as for health purposes. But what it does do is change the manner in which those samples are retained and used by the Department of Health. Currently, the practice is that those samples are retained. There is a opt-out procedure that is permitted. What this does is reverse that and requires a informed consent to opt in to the project of having the samples retained by the Department of Health and used for other purposes beyond just the screening for disease that occurs or for conditions that occur after birth. I apologize. I may not have all the technical. I know that in the section 2 there is a subdivision 2 there is a change, and perhaps counsel can help me speak to what that refers to. But section 3 deals with the reversal of, the form of consent, and it essentially says that persons with the duty to perform testing shall advise parents of infants that the blood or tissue samples will be used to perform testing and that a form is available which is intended to be a consent that would be conformative to the other parts of the law that talk about informed consent. And that form is available, which may be chosen with respect to the testing. They also have the right to decline the tests and elect to have the tests and to allow the blood samples and records to be retained for 24 months after the testing. On Section 4, it has to do with the duty of the Commissioner and the Department of Health with respect to the blood samples, that they currently maintain a registry that is deleted as in paragraph 3. They're not allowed to maintain that registry. And other deleted language on top of page 3 is in reference to the current practice. And we've replaced that with paragraph 3 and 4 on lines 3.7, 3.12. That requires the department to destroy these samples unless the parents have elected to retain the results, and also to direct them to destroy all the things that they have collected without consent and they currently have in their possession. Section 5 is some definitions. And that may be getting into the next section of the bill. And if you would like, I can go through that. The next section of the bill, starting in Section 5, has to do with parental consent for minor medical treatment. Section 5 has a line on 4.6 and 7 that states that a parent or guardian is entitled to full access to a minor child's health records except as otherwise explicitly provided. Section 6 provides consent of a minor to certain medical procedures. Defines some terms in Subdivision 1. Subdivision 2, it says that the minor's consent is invalid with the exceptions for sexual abuse, incest, and physical abuse. Going over to page 5, which provides a court to review in the case that a minor is declaring that they should be given an exception to parental consent. Subdivision 4 is a section that talks about the judicial determination of that claim. Subdivision 5, costs associated puts the costs associated with the judicial determination into the cost of the Commissioner of Health.
Sir Han, would you want counsel to give a comment about that now?
If that would be helpful, I think, if she's willing to do that.
Perhaps you could give a reference on page and line so that counsel knows where you're directing them.
I was talking about Subdivision 5 on page 6, and I guess it refers back to also Subdivision 4, the judicial determination.
Mr. Backus?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I see the reference. What was the question again, Senator Han?
Could you explain this provision of the bill?
This
is a new rewrite.
Mr. Chair, this is an attempt so that essentially to hold the courts harmless in terms of the costs associated with the determination required under Subdivision 4, which is the determination whereby a judge would have to determine whether the minor was the victim of the physical, sexual, or abuse or incest, and whether the procedure would be in the minor's best interest. So this would require the court to calculate the amount of time and court resources used in determining that, including the use of a guardian ad litem and court-appointed counsel, then forward that to the court administrator who would attempt to put a monetary value on that, essentially bill that to the Commissioner of Management and Budget, who would then reimburse the court so that they were again held harmless for those costs.
Senator Han.
Mr. Chairman, and we have requested a fiscal note on this. And we don't have that yet, but asking for an assessment of that by the fiscal analyst.
Senator Han, is it the intent of this rewrite, that if there were any costs, would it be absorbed by the court system or would it be absorbed by some other entity?
Mr. Chairman, and as counsel has indicated, the intent is to not burden the courts with additional costs, but to reflect those costs such as they may be as part of the cost of the Department of Health.
All right. Please proceed.
Subdivision 6 on page 6 refers to a penalty, regarding performance of a service in violation of this. There's a severability clause in subdivision 7. Section 7 talks about in the case of minors in out-of-home placement and essentially allowing for adults who have effective control or responsibility for minors who are not at home to be the accountable party. And Section 8 is a reference to Title 10 funding. To do things in violation of Title 10. And then Section 9 is a repealer that has the repealer language listed there that, as I have been informed, would be unnecessary if this bill were to pass.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Hand. Are there any questions for Senator Hand? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if maybe Senator Hoffman could help me a little bit. If we could go to page 2, if you could, Senator Hoffman, give me a brief explanation as to the blood and tissue samples that are being retained. You know, what's the purpose of the retainage, the taking of the blood and the sample? What is the medical profession doing with those samples? Why are they being taken?
Well, Senator Newman, we may have other people giving testimony today that might be able to better proponents of the bill or even opponents of the bill may be able to answer your question. I'm not sure if Senator Hoffman is ready to answer your question. Are you ready to answer his question?
It's pretty early, Mr. Chair. Basically, from my limited professional knowledge, it's the heel stick that they do the babies right after they're born. They're just testing for an enzyme to make sure they can digest food properly. That's what the original purpose of that is. As far as why they're storing it, that is out of my area of expertise.
Thank you, Senator.
Any other questions for Senator Hand at this time? Next person on our agenda would be Twyla Brace from Citizens Council for Health Freedom, speaking in favor of the bill. And following Twyla Brace, Tom Pritchard should probably come up to the table as well so we can keep our time frame going. Ms. Brace, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I have a handout for members if someone would like to come up and get it. I'll leave it right here. There you go, Mr.
Thank you.
All right. My comments are really about the baby DNA section, about the taking of the storage, the dissemination, and the use of the newborn blood spots and the genetic information. But I will say that I support the language on 4.6 and 4.7 that gives parents access to their children's records, because I've heard from so many parents who cannot get access but are being asked to pay the bills and have no idea what actually happened. So I don't know the details really of the rest of the bill, but I just want to put that out there on the table. So regarding the other sections that have to do with the newborn screening and the retention of newborn DNA, I know that some of you are new to this issue and others know it like the back of your hand. So this is the eighth year that this issue has come before the legislature in some form or fashion. Our organization discovered it in 2003 during a discussion about bill language expanding newborn screening. And I'll just interject here regarding what Senator Hoffman said, a lot of people still believe that the newborn screen is simply the heel stick for the PKU, but the heel stick has gone up to, there are 53 conditions for which children are now tested at birth as a result of the heel stick. So it has gone beyond the PKU that you were talking about. At that time in 2003, we discovered the baby DNA warehouse, the collection of the children's DNA, and the state database containing the genetic test results of Minnesota children. We learned that the Minnesota Department of Health was collecting, retaining, using, and disseminating the DNA and genetic test results of newborns without the consent or knowledge of parents. The database began on July 1, 1986, and now has the genetic test results of approximately 1.7 million children. The storage of DNA began on July 1, 1986. The DNA of approximately 1 million children is now held and owned by the state of Minnesota. In addition, more than 52,000 children have been the subjects of state-endorsed genetic research without the knowledge or consent of their parents. Although we succeeded in giving parents the right to destroy the test results and DNA at that time, we did not realize that those opt-out rights did not include parent rights to be actually told about their opt-out rights. We started hearing from new parents on our email list about their experiences at the hospital. Hospitals had no idea parents had the right to opt out or that they needed to have certain official forms to allow parents to exercise these rights. 3 years later, during testimony on the Parents' Right to Say No bill, the department promised to better inform parents and hospitals about how parents' rights to object to opt out of the storage, use, and dissemination of baby DNA. However, the rule they proposed in 2006 didn't even require the usual Tennyson warning, and thus we objected. The administrative law judge agreed to the need for a Tennyson warning and found the department out of compliance with the 2006 Minnesota Genetic Privacy Act, which forbids the collection, storage, use, or dissemination of genetic information without written informed consent. The department appealed the decision and lost. Beginning in 2007, the department began to try to exempt the newborn genetic screening program from the state genetic privacy law, including the retention and use of the DNA. They did not succeed, yet they have continued to collect, store, use, and disseminate genetic test information and DNA without parent consent. With our help on March 11, 2009, nine families sued the Minnesota Department of Health for violation of the Minnesota Genetic Privacy Act. The case was eventually appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court, where it was heard on March 1st of this year. We await what we hope will be a favorable ruling. At issue are the genetic privacy rights, parent rights, and DNA property rights of individuals. The child's DNA and the genetic test results become state government property when they enter the department, and those children eventually become adults whose DNA is considered property of the department. I was at an Institute of Medicine meeting in Washington, D.C. last year where proponents of a national registry of baby DNA prefer that each state becomes a repository of this DNA and a steward of the child's DNA. Without a doubt, there's nothing more personal, more unique, and more open for abuse or misuse than an individual's DNA. Various studies and forums across the country have emerged as a result of our organization's call to destroy the illegally retained newborn DNA cards. Beth Tarini at the University of Michigan published a paper called Not Without My Permission. She found parents quite unwilling to have states store or use their children's DNA without permission. In fact, many parents were only willing to agree to the consent if they could agree to the research if they could determine which studies their children were used for, and they wanted to give their consent for each and every study or refuse to have it used for each and every study. Sharon Cardia, another researcher, reported at a conference that people participating in focus groups she held are shocked when they learn about the retention. Some told her it must be illegal. We are not the only state with surprised or outraged parents. Parents in Texas not only found out about the state's retention of their baby's DNA, they also discovered that the state health department had bartered their children's blood for equipment, sold it to corporations, and shared it with the U.S. military for the creation of a law enforcement DNA database. In particular, they asked for the DNA of Hispanics and blacks. There is now a class action lawsuit in Texas. Many parents support newborn screening, although as it expands to more and more conditions, that may change. But as this new research shows, they do not support government retention, ownership, and use of their children's DNA for internal or external research projects, They are particularly insensitive about it being done without legal authority or parent consent. As I consider Senator Hand's bill, I want to draw your attention to two important aspects of the newborn DNA sections. We are pleased that the state government retention and use of newborn DNA would require actual written informed consent, which is in Section 3 of the bill and requires a form. Today, parents have little chance of knowing what's happening because many parents do not find their brochure or read the fine print until long after they've left the hospital. We do believe it is very important, however, that you establish your intent today in the hearing, within the hearing of the health department and on public record, that parents be informed not only of any potential benefits but also of the array of potential risks. The department should be required to give parents a Tennyson warning with a request for consent so parents know that this is a serious decision and that it could impact their children's future. I will show you, and I forgot to make a copy of it, and here we go. This is a Tennyson warning, and it says on the top, Tennyson warning for employees. This is the department's brochure that if you get far enough into it, you find a section that tells you you have some options. But it's a lovely brochure and nothing that would actually be looked at like a warning of any kind. Parents have told me that they have found this from 2 to 6 months after the birth of their baby and long after the DNA was taken. So parents should be informed that the state would be storing their children's DNA, not just a blood spot or a blood sample. A soon-to-be-published research report will show that parents want to be told that this is actually their children's DNA. And they should be told that their child's DNA becomes state government property available for future legislative priorities if they allow it to be stored by the state. Although I see in Senator Hand's bill, it does say that there's a limit of 2 years. But as we know, legislatures come and go, and that could change. So we still believe that they should know that it's state government property. We also support the required destruction of newborn screening cards and genetic test results database. These were created without statutory authority and are being used for research without statutory authority as well. You may be interested to know that the Texas Department of Health require 2.5 semi-trucks to haul their 5.2 million newborn screening cards to the incinerator under order of a judge. Finally, I want to draw your attention to our handouts. There you'll see some statistics about the growing number of parents who, once informed by our organization of their options, choose to have their children's test results and DNA destroyed. But they have to find out about it. They have to take it upon themselves to do the paperwork, and then they have to make sure that they get the paperwork back saying that this actually happened. And parents sometimes don't get that paperwork. There are also copies of department emails, documents from the department's IRB research files, and one Taking Baby DNA story. In conclusion, Citizens Council for Health Freedom supports this bill and the restoration of genetic privacy rights, parent rights, and DNA property rights that it brings to Minnesota parents and newborn citizens. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Senator Hand.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members. It is the intent, or my intent, with this bill to not interfere with the newborn screening. I know that that can be, for some, controversial. This is, in my opinion, independent of that. This is not intended to interfere with the ability for physicians to take a sample and to perform the tests, even though, as Ms. Braze has indicated, sometimes that may be, for some, a matter of controversy, but that's not the intent of this bill. This bill is to focus on what happens after the screening is done and whose property the DNA sample is. I believe that it should be the presumption in Minnesota that that is the property of the individual, or in this case, because of the infant status of the parents, to make a determination of whether or not those samples should be used for research. And we're not denying that as a possibility, but we believe it should be done with explicit informed consent on the part of the parents instead of what seems to be the case today, which is a presumption on the part of the state to be able to retain and use this material for purposes that they determine, in many cases without the knowledge of or the consent of the parents of the child from whom the tissue was taken.
Okay. Members, what we're planning on doing today is offering 20 minutes for proponents, 20 minutes for opposition, And then we'll have hopefully a remainder of about 45 to 60 minutes for discussion and questions. But we really want to get the testimony in and on the record. Mr. Pritchard.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I'm here to speak in support of the provisions dealing with the minor consent law. I would say that a few points. One is that in the years subsequent to the passage of the minor consent law, child well-being has declined. Child depression, suicide, substance abuse, binge drinking, sexually transmitted diseases, age of sexual activity is lowered, all have grown in problems. Kids aren't happier or better off in the intervening years. We believe that isolating minors from their parents isn't making things better. These are enormous life-changing issues, drug, alcohol, abuse, sexually transmitted diseases, pregnancy. And we think parents should be involved in these areas in their children's lives, their minor children's lives. And I think it's important that parents are involved. In fact, the Department of Health in a report called Strategies for Public Health in 2002 said, quote, "Very little attention is given to the important role that parents play in the healthy development of their adolescent children. Their importance in the lives of their teens is strongly supported in research, particularly current research on resiliency." We believe that this amendment, or this bill, will in fact help improve the medical care for minor kids. Kids need their parents to be their advocate and guide them through the medical system to ensure they receive the best care possible. Current law is putting kids at greater risk of serious health problems. Imagine your teenage son has a drug problem and doesn't want you to know about it. He receives treatment from a doctor who prescribes a powerful drug to treat the problem. You are not involved or notified of the treatment. Your son experiences serious allergic reaction, rendering him unconscious. You're there left to pick up the pieces, not knowing what his problem is. We think this bill will also protect against sexual exploitation. Right now, sexual predators can prey on minor girls under the cloak of secrecy this law provides. We believe this law will also protect the families and the constitutional rights of families and parents and their vital role in raising their children, which we believe are protected by the U.S. Constitution. We believe that, in fact, this current law undermines the ability of parents to be parents. Parents can be held criminally liable for endangerment or neglect if they fail to provide proper medical care for their children under current law. Yet this law specifically excludes parents from being involved in critical medical decisions involving drug and alcohol abuse, pregnancy issues, and sexually transmitted diseases. So it really undermines the ability of parents to care and to fulfill their responsibilities under the law. Some will argue that repealing the current law, teens won't get the necessary medical or health care they need. But this isn't verified by research. In fact, a study that was done testing behavior, not teens' attitudes on whether they would receive treatment, found that, in fact, teens were more likely to seek help if they knew their parents were involved. So we believe that the exact opposite is the situation. And some would argue that this will open the door to abuse of children. If we repeal this ability, it's going to force kids to go to abusive parents before they can get treatment, but that's not true. Under this bill, there would be an exemption for incest. And also, under current law, any professional who suspects abuse of a minor child is required under state law to report that to protective services. I'd just like to close with quoting from a testimony given by a young woman several years ago, testifying on this bill, similar language, and I thought it was quite compelling. Her name was Katie, a young woman, and she said, quote, "I started drinking, then having sex when I was about to turn 17. I was able to go to a family planning clinic to get all the help I needed without my parents even knowing. The family planning clinic supplied birth control, as well as testing me for sexually transmitted diseases. The clinic knew about my alcohol and drug abuse, but did not encourage me to get treatment for that or to involve my parents. In fact, I was encouraged to keep my deep secrets at the clinic as opposed to letting my family in. It caused a wall between my parents and me. This secrecy made it easy for me to continue the unhealthy behaviors, drug and alcohol abuse, as well as the sexual activity. If my parents had known what I was doing at the clinic, I would have still gone in for testing and medical treatment. I know the dangers of STDs, and I am terrified of the results. Still, I continued in my unhealthy lifestyle because my parents were not aware of my behavior. My addiction progressed from alcohol and sex to weed, meth, heroin, and everything in between, to ultimately shooting straight adrenaline. I continued the unhealthy lifestyle because I did not feel accountable to anyone. I know that if my parents had been involved sooner, I would not have been sucked down as far as I was. Keeping these secrets from my parents just caused more addiction, and it was acceptable, even encouraged, to hide it from them. When you keep secrets from people, you keep them as far away as possible so they do not find out. That in itself tears families apart. So we believe this is good legislation and strongly support it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I personally became aware of this presumption of minor consent in the case of one of my own children. At the time was an adolescent, I believe 13 or 14 years old. We had been having difficulties with this child and were concerned about what was going on, behavior and other activities that we saw some evidence of, concerned for the health of this child. We made an appointment to have the child examined by a physician so that we could determine if there was something that we should be aware of so that we could provide some help. We did have that appointment, and following that appointment, I met with the physician and asked, well, what is it that we need to know? And I was told that unless our child consented, we could know nothing. And I found that surprising, and I said, why? What's the basis of that? And they said, that is Minnesota law. Now, as it turned out, that those issues persisted in the case of this child for another two or three years. Eventually, we did learn through actually an intervention where we had to place this child in a mental health screening clinic, in the course of which the child was forthcoming about the things that had been going on, and at that time we learned the things that we needed to know, but it was 2 years following the appointment that we had with the physician. I was surprised, and I think many parents today would be surprised to know that they do not have the ability to know the health condition of their minor children. I think the presumption should be the reverse of what it is today. The presumption should be that parents should know and be in a position to help. We do recognize that there are some circumstances, and I would argue they are rare, but they are certainly exist, and when they exist, they are serious, that would suggest that parents should not be the ones consenting to treatment. And so we have tried to provide for that in the course of this bill by allowing for some independent review of those circumstances so that if there is an issue with the parents, that can become known and dealt with. But I believe that we ought to, as a state, presume that most parents are acting in the interests of their children. And as part of that interest, they need to know what is going on with the health of their children.
Thank you, Senator Hand. In opposition, I'd like to call Dr. Ann Edwards to the table, and followed by Dr. Patty Simmons from the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Edwards, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. My name is Ann Edwards, and I'm a general pediatrician, and I come to you this morning on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, an organization dedicated to the health and well-being of all children in the state, not for pediatricians. And I come to this committee with great concern about the impact of Senate File 1017 would have on all children in the state of Minnesota. Some of my colleagues will address the concerns surrounding newborn screening language changes which concern Minnesota's pediatric community greatly as well. However, today I would like to spend a few moments discussing the language in this bill which would repeal the minor consent for adolescents. As a general pediatrician, I have the privilege of partnering with parents and families to assure that each child reach adult in optimal health and mental health. Minor consent removes potential barriers for adolescents in accessing both acute care and preventative care, such as vaccines. I would like to provide two examples of how minor consent benefits our children and their families. I have a patient who came to me to seek care and confidence regarding concerns of a sexually transmitted disease, which she actually did not have. However, this became an entry into my office where trust was built, and she was able to share her concerns about her mother's own mental well-being and drug abuse. Not only did this lead to her mother obtaining appropriate care, but also for this teen to find a safe place with a family member to live. Some of these stories are disturbing. A colleague of mine shared a story of a teen who, after her third episode of pelvic inflammatory disease, which is a complication of sexually transmitted infections, she was then able to share that her stepfather had been raping her, and thus he had infected her. Her safety was only made possible through minor consent without the additional high hurdle and pain of court proceedings. A repeal of minor consent serves to delay optimal care. Such delays lead to additional cost, pain, missed days of school and opportunities for further education, higher cost of care with delayed care, and future health care costs. Certainly, I could share stories of parents and teens who come together to have difficult conversations in my presence, or teens who come to alone, but after careful discussion in future visits, parents are nearly always present. However, the unfortunate reality is this is not always possible, nor ideal, nor does it guarantee optimal health for all teens. All our children deserve the very best. Thus, as an advocate for children and teens, I must urge you not to pass Senate File 1017. Thank you. I stand ready for questions.
Thank you. We're going to hold questions until later, okay, after all of the testimony is completed. Dr. Patty Simmons. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Leonard. And I appreciate, Chair Leonard, that you're having this early because I have patience. I get to go back and see in Rochester. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I come as a pediatrician, Dr. Patricia Simmons, to speak on behalf of Mayo Clinic, where I work, in opposition to this bill. I speak with great respect for Senator Hahn. We don't agree on everything, but we both have deep passion about children and families in Minnesota. The reason we oppose this bill at Mayo Clinic is we believe there would be unintended consequences of two provisions of this bill that would result in hurting children, hurting families, and increasing costs in health care and costs to the state. I'll speak briefly because I think we've heard a number of points made about some specific issues that have already been raised. With respect to the decision on the newborn screening, it is critically important that families must opt out rather than opt in. Studies have demonstrated how many cases of preventable, manageable disease we would miss that would kill and seriously harm children, brain damage, change their lives, change the lives of families, if we made that switch. The burden is on the providers to make sure we get the appropriate knowledge and education and informed consent, of course. The storage of the blood spots is critically important to the quality of these tests and to understanding the diseases that affected children have. Minnesota has an unusually good program because we do quality control on the tests. We need the blood spots to do that. Otherwise, the risk of falsely negative missing diseases is higher. The risk of false positives, making a diagnosis that doesn't exist and bringing great alarm to families, is high. There's a wonderful example from our state that I think speaks to how valuable it is to be able to interpret and understand the data. And please, these tests are about they're biochemical tests, largely for these conditions. A family who came into a lot of money in our state stated in a press conference that they vowed to devote their new fortune to the establishment of a newborn screening test for Krabbe disease. Why? Because that condition killed their grandchild 5 years before. Here in Minnesota, we wouldn't have to start from scratch in developing a test because we have data to help us get there. We could develop a test to prevent this kind of tragedy from occurring again for Krabbe and related conditions. I'd like to turn to speak about minor consent statutes. I'm a pediatrician. I need to have a very trusting, good relationship with the families I serve, with the patients I serve. They come to me because they trust me. I need to continue that trust. I'm a portal to help children engage their families in their well-being and in their care. Sometimes the barrier's high. They're afraid because they've done something wrong. They've gone to a party they shouldn't have gone to. Something happened there. There's now a high risk of a medical consequence. They're afraid to tell. They get to come see their pediatrician. We go through it. We say, here's why it's important we get the help of your parents. I regret that anyone ever, ever cuts parents out of this. They shouldn't. The law doesn't make us do that. The law helps us, enables us to provide the best care we can. Please, we don't want to do anything that discourages adolescents from getting help. It's already hard enough to be an adolescent. We want to be able to engage families. And the way we do that sometimes is by having that outside trusted individual leverage the relationship. I see many, many adolescents. I see them alone. We establish the parameters up front with the patient, with the family. The families are grateful that a knowledgeable, caring adult is going to talk with their child, learn from their child, and they know that I'm going to do everything I can to help them, and that includes engaging their parents. So please, I hope you'll consider the children of our state, our families, and frankly, the health care costs and the societal costs if we undermine consent to care from minors and if we undermine our newborn screening program. With that, I thank you very much. And again, with due respect.
Thank you, Dr. Simmons. Bridget Riley, and then followed by Marianne Kuhn, or Kuhn. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Riley.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bridget Riley, and I'm the executive director of MOAP, which is the Minnesota Organization on Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention and Parenting. I'm here to share my concern about the changes that are proposed to the state's minor consent statute in Senate File 1017. And I want to share that the statute has played a critical role in helping Minnesota achieve the lowest teen pregnancy rate on record. And it's been an important tool for medical providers, as you have heard, for four decades now, giving them the ability to create trusting relationships, to create those connections with young people who often have no other trusted adult in their lives. The ability to assure confidentiality gives providers an avenue to facilitate communication about these very sensitive issues, like pregnancy, like sexually transmitted infections, HIV, alcohol, and drug use. And I want to make a distinction here. I want to highlight a distinction here. In practice, the statute allows a healthcare provider to provide care confidentially. It allows a healthcare provider to do so. It doesn't require a healthcare provider to do so. So we know that the young people who receive services most often confidentially under this statute, they are those who are least connected to family, to school, to community. And I'm afraid that removing the opportunity for a positive interaction with a trustworthy adult is going to cause even more chaos in their life. I brought copies of our adolescent sexual health report for you if you care to take a look at that. But it demonstrates pretty clearly that while our pregnancy rate has gone down, there are many other issues that young people are facing regarding sexual health. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Marianne Kuhn. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marianne Kuhn. I am the State Program Director for the March of Dimes. And on behalf of the March of Dimes, I'm testifying in opposition to the provisions of Senate File 1017 that would eliminate parental education about the benefit of retaining newborn screening blood samples. And I would like to raise some concerns regarding the proposed parental consent requirement for the retention of newborn screening test results in blood samples. Each year, under Minnesota state law, the Minnesota Department of Health screens more than 73,000 newborns for rare and serious medical conditions. These disorders have no immediate visible effects on a baby, but unless they are detected and treated early, they can cause severe debilitation, intellectual disabilities, and even death. The March of Dimes supports parental education about newborn screening and believes that education should include information on treatable conditions, on testing for disorders for which treatment is not yet available, and on state policies for the storage, retention, and use of blood spots. Senate File 1017 eliminates the parental education component about the benefit of retaining blood samples. Therefore, this bill would further limit parents' ability to make an informed decision about their child's blood samples. Senate File 1017 proposes to require parental consent for the retention of the newborn screening test results and to eliminate the registry of the cases of heritable and congenital disorders detected by the screening program. These proposed changes would adversely affect the ability of the program to provide follow-up services, which are critical to these families. Destroying the newborn blood samples as soon as newborn testing occurs will cause parents to lose the ability to verify the test results with the health department and may potentially pose a liability threat to the department if test results cannot be verified. Currently, the newborn screening program permits parents to decline to have the test performed on their child or to elect to have the test performed but to require the department to destroy the blood sample and the test results. This procedure can be strengthened to ensure that parents are aware of this option and to ensure that they are aware of the benefits of this highly effective public health prevention program. Therefore, the March of Dimes respectfully requests that you oppose the provisions in Senate File 1017 that would negatively affect the newborn screening program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a few more minutes left over for the opposition to speak. Is anyone else in the room? I want to make sure that we provide a fair hearing. Could you please approach the table? Oh, I'm sorry. We have Ms. Aggie Lighthizer coming. And then after that, if we have more time in the 20 minutes allotted, we'll provide that for opposition comments further. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here today to inform you about concerns we have about the impact of the proposed language in Senate File 1017 for both newborn screening and minor consent. If the bill is passed as written or as even in the amendment, it would seriously undermine our ability to screen babies for life-threatening disorders. In particular, eliminating the registry would negatively affect babies found by the screening to have serious conditions. Each year, we identify about 150 babies born with one of these conditions identified by the newborn screening program. And because it's early, I did the math. That's about 1 in 500 children born in Minnesota. This would limit our ability to ensure that the parents of children with these very rare conditions are connected to supportive resources and that parents are aware of the treatment and service options for their children. Secondly, parents of children with serious conditions and their doctors will not have access to the baby samples and test results. Regularly, calls come into the department from clinics who are seeing the child, who are seeing a pregnant mom who think their last child's test result was abnormal, or from specialty clinics needing to confirm the results of a test. We would no longer be able to answer those questions. We may no longer meet the requirements for the certification of the public health laboratory system, which would put both the newborn screening program and potentially other public health laboratory testing programs at risk. The Federal Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments, a federal requirement, requires laboratories record and maintain all test results for 24 months. This bill would allow parents to opt out of that 24-month period, which would put our certification at risk. Not retaining samples impacts testing quality control and quality assurance. You already heard some comments about that. The ability to retest specimens that are reported as false negatives would be lost, as we would not maybe see those results for a year or more. One particular test for cystic fibrosis is not reliable until at least 1 month of age, and many metabolic disorders require months to confirm clinically. We would have limited ability to evaluate existing tests and to develop new tests. Because we are able to track test results over time, we identified the need to change the cutoff values for one test result in Hmong babies, which reduced the number of false positive results. Parents that provide consent for storage of specimens may not be representative of the population as a whole, so we may no longer be able to do these sorts of studies. I'd like to turn now for a few comments about the minor consent law. It's an important public health tool that allows access to health services for a limited number of critical health conditions, and you've heard about those already. The legislature passed a law in 1971 recognizing the needs of vulnerable youth, including those who are homeless, abused, and neglected, or otherwise alienated, who needed information and treatment for sensitive health conditions. And you already heard that providing access to care in this way can help be a bridge through the health professional to their parents. We may see increases in minors who think they have an HIV or sexually transmitted disease who don't get tested or treated, so they go on to infect others. This is especially concerning for populations with higher rates of teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections. Minors may not seek prenatal care, resulting in unintended pregnancy or poor pregnancy outcomes. They may not seek help for their substance abuse, resulting in violence and other poor outcomes. We may see increased future health problems and increased health care results as a result of these changes. Minors' consent and the ability of adolescents to access confidential health services are strongly supported by many state and national health organizations, and you heard from a few of them today. We would like to engage the author in discussion about important policy and health considerations surrounding newborn screening and minor consent. In its current form, we believe the bill to be untenable. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, testimony supporting and opposing will be over at this time. The opposition as well as the support have both satisfied the 20 minutes on either side of that discussion. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would like to clarify again the intent of what this bill would do. It is not the intent, nor do I understand the fact of the language, to interfere with the screening process of infants. And although I recognize that that may be controversial among some, that is not the issue that this bill confronts. It does not prevent or prohibit the kind of research that we've heard testimony that by some believe is very beneficial. It does not prohibit that at all. What it does require is that there be informed consent to participate in that research, and if the benefits are there, those benefits can certainly be presented to parents at the time of the testing and get their informed consent to participate in that. What this bill, I think, is really challenging is the current presumption in law that the government or third-party providers are in a better position to make critical decisions about children's health rather than parents. And I believe that that is should be exactly the opposite, that we should expect and rely on the ability and the desire of parents to have the primary interest of the health of their children. We do understand there are exceptions. We have provided for that in the bill. But the presumption that somehow an expert should be the one making decisions without informed consent or without perhaps the knowledge or consent at all of parents, I believe, is not the direction that we as a state should support.
Thank you. Also, for the record, in your packages, there's a comment that apparently was given in 2005, written by Professor Teresa Collette in opposition or in favor of the bill before us. We'll now open it up for questions. Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, what happens in the case with your bill of juveniles who are adolescents who are suffering from depression and their parents deny that there's any mental illness, and if they're afraid to tell their parents, I'm knowing that they're afraid to go to court to get some kind of approval, and they are. They are suicidal or commit suicide because they cannot go to a physician to get the medication that they need.
Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin, We have provided for circumstances where minors can seek to be the consenting person, but as in many things involving adolescents, the real question is, are adolescents fully capable of making decisions? And if not, who should make decisions for them on their behalf? And all we're trying to do is establish the presumption that it is parents who should be in that position. We do acknowledge in the bill that there are exceptions to that, and we have provided for that. But I think what I believe is currently the circumstance is that the presumption in the law does more harm than good. That there may be circumstances, as were pointed out, but this bill would permit those circumstances to be addressed. But in many cases where you have parents who have the best interests of their children in mind are not permitted. You may have an adolescent child who is in rebellion or in opposition or going through a period of their life where they are not in a relationship with their parents and they are involved in things, and having the structure of the law today enables that behavior to continue without the opportunity for parents to have the chance to understand and be of help. I believe that the overwhelming majority of parents in this state want to be of help to their children, and it is frustrating, I believe, to have a law that says, well, that can only happen if the adolescent who may be going through conditions that would interfere with their clear and mature thinking on this to allow their parents to be a participant in those decisions. So this bill would reverse that presumption, and I think that is the right way to approach it.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Goodwin.
But Senator Hahn, I don't see anything in this bill that has any other access for a juvenile except to go to court unless they're in a foster facility or residential treatment center. But if they're not, if they're living at home, I don't see any tell me where it is, and I'll look at it. But I just see that they only have the option to go to court.
Senator Hall. Right, Senator. It is early, isn't it? Sarah, go ahead. Sarah Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Goodwin. Again, the presumption is that we want to encourage parents to be involved in the decision-making of their children's health. And under circumstances where there are chances of harm to the child as a result of the parents knowing, we're trying to provide for that. I don't think that the current practice protects every child from harm. I don't think any change in the law will protect and guarantee that no harm will come to any child. I don't think we can possibly do that in law. The real question is whether the presumption is going to be that parents be involved in these decisions or third parties replacing parents as the presumption.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
And Senator Hahn, well, I have to disagree with you. It's a beautiful world you're sending out there, but unfortunately it's less true than you think in many, many cases. But I worked in children's mental health, and I saw adolescents that were unable to talk to their parents about their depression. Probably good parents in a number of ways, but they were just in denial that their child particularly could have mental health problems. I've seen suicides and attempted suicides because those adolescents and teens were unable to speak to their parents about it. If we're going to pass anything, that's going to create an issue where even one child's life is gone because they couldn't get the help that they needed, then I think we're doing the wrong thing here.
Senator Goodwin, I'd like to ask counsel to give a description of the exception that is in the bill. Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and members, the exception is located on page 5, line 12, and it provides that the subdivision 2 provision on consent does not apply if the attending physician certifies in the minor's medical record that the services are necessary to prevent the minor's death and there is insufficient time to obtain consent. So that provision would apply if the judicial determination, if the child decided not to go that route.
And
Sarah Goodwin?
Mr. Chair, the determine, so it's an and issue, it has to be both. Well, that's not always good. That's seldom going to be the case in a situation like this.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator can.
And, Mr. Chair, and I recognize that no law can be perfect, but I think it is also fair to say that under the current structure of the law, there is certainly harm that is being done to children as a result of the current law. I don't think there's any law that we could devise that will guarantee that no harm will come to children. What this really is about is whether there should be a presumption that parents are the ones in the best position to make decisions about their children. I don't think this law prohibits, in the case of a minor child going to a physician, that physician saying, well, here's the story, but I am obliged by law to inform your parents. There's nothing that would prohibit that, so that the physician would then, I believe, have a positive duty to inform parents, rather than, as it is today, they have a positive duty to not inform parents unless the adolescent agrees to that information. That is the difference I think we're making in the bill.
Senator Hall.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if we could get a view from the council as to whether if this bill would change our current parental notification laws specifically for abortion.
Council.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, this bill replaces the notification law with a consent requirement. So if you look at the repealer, there's also a copy of the current law that I think you have. That's being repealed.
Sir Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for me, the most poignant story of all of the testifiers that we've heard this morning is that of Senator Hand's personal story, and one that until this morning I had never heard, which is quite candidly just the opposite of every one of the other testifiers that testified in opposition to this bill. Senator Hand, contrary to the opponents of the bill, testified that he was excluded as a parent from being involved in the medical treatment of his child. And I'm just stunned by that. I had no idea that that was really going out there. And yet the opponents of this bill, one after another, came up to the table and say it only happens in exceptional circumstances. So, you know, I would just encourage the members to listen to what Senator Hand had to say about his personal experience. To me, the most powerful story of all of the testifiers that came forward today.
And, Mr. Chair.
Sir Hand.
And I want to be candid. We have four children. We had this experience with one of our four. In other cases, and I'm sure the testifiers against the bill will acknowledge that in many cases adolescents don't have any problem in giving consent to say, sure, let mom and dad know. But the concern to me is when, as we were dealing with a child who was, we knew, in trouble, and we wanted to help, and we were prohibited from learning what we needed to learn to be of help to our child by the law. And I think that is the harm that the current structure of the law does. And the presumption that most parents are going to do harm to their kids and therefore the kids need to be protected from the parents, I think is exactly contrary to what most parents want. When they have a troubled adolescent, they want to be of help. And to have a law that gets in the way of that, I think, needs to be changed.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schein.
Mr. Chairman, I would err on the side of the child and the child's safety. I understand the parental frustration. I've felt that frustration in terms of mental health issues in the raising of my children. But, Senator Hand, are you saying that you took your teenager, your adolescent, to the doctor, and the doctor said, I looked at your child, and we've done this test and that test, and I can't tell you what the results are? Did that happen?
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, they would not inform me at all what they did. And they said they could only inform me if my daughter, who was the child in question, agreed. And I had a very lengthy and unfortunately a little heated conversation with the physician and with the physician supervisor to say, we are trying to help our child. We need to know what is going on. And they said, unless your child agrees, we cannot tell you anything about what the treatment is or what we did, and that's what we were told.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Hand, that was when you took her yourself. You were with her.
Mr. Chairman, we took our child. We were there, not in the examining room, but we were there in the office. We waited, and we paid the bill.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, before getting into the substance of it, I came here, and I agree it was about 8 or 9 minutes late, but I come here and see a delete everything amendment has the abortion notification law, which has been around a long time, changing that, a delete everything amendment, and this bill was never heard in Health and Human Services other than some parts of it showed up in the omnibus bill, and I objected to the fact it hadn't been heard. Then it's heard on the last day of the budget deadline in Judiciary Committee, and I don't know. I mean, there's a whole new court procedure in here. I'm not sure. I don't know that I didn't see that in the previous version of the bill, and courts I don't see anybody hear from. I guess I have a lot of concerns about the process. I trust this bill will be going to Health and Human Services after this. But, Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, your exception on page 5, if the attending physician certifies in the minor's medical record services are necessary to prevent the minor's death. I mean, a whole lot of cases where a kid is suicidal, potentially suicidal, it's a pretty strong thing to certify that if you don't do this, the minor is going to die. I mean, there's a lot of things that, yes, it will increase the risk of the minor happening, but there's a whole lot of cases where there's a lot of shades of gray in here, and it seems to me the expecting of a kid who's struggling is going to go to court. I mean, it seems to me the person I'd want child to see, and both when our kids were this age and so on, was to see a doctor. I want them to talk with a doctor. And, yes, we had the same thing where we couldn't. We asked our kids, can we see this stuff? And, yes. And in a case where things are going well, their kids do that. But if it's a choice between getting treatment for an STI or getting help with mental health or chemical dependency treatment, I think this bill is going to do a couple of things. One, it's going to stop kids from going to the doctor. It's going to stop them from getting treatment. It's going to mean more risk of suicide. Yeah, not every one of them is going to commit suicide. It's going to mean more of them don't get their sexually transmitted infection checked. We've got 1 in 4 teenage girls in this state has an STI. You might call it an epidemic, and we're going to make it a lot worse. The red trends, according to MOAP, look like they've been pretty good in the last few years. They've been improving. And the other thing it'll do is cause more kids to run away. I mean, when I look at how what a shelter is supposed to do, or somebody else who's watching over the out-of-home, a kid who's in out-of-home placement, they can give consent after they've tried to contact the parent, for the parent to do it. I mean, the kid ran away for a reason usually. And the idea that, yeah, the kid can go in and claim, yeah, I was a victim of abuse or neglect, not neglect, but of, I think you have sexual assault or sexual abuse or physical abuse, if certain things, in other words, the kid has to say, I'm going to charge my parents with a crime or I can't get anything. And I just don't think that's not the real world. Kids are not going to go, a kid who's at risk, maybe they are being abused, and maybe we do want the parents reported. But a 14-year-old kid who's being abused, expecting them to go to court and charge their parents with a crime, isn't going to happen. I wonder if that doctor is still here. I'd kind of like to ask her how, when she deals with the pediatrician, Mr. Chair, I don't know if she's still around, and I don't know if we can ask a question at this time.
Senator Marty, are you asking for the Senator Hahn to make comment to your...
I'd like Senator concerns. Hahn's comments, but I also wondered about if we can ask the pediatrician again.
That's fine. Would you come up to the table, and then Senator Hahn, why don't you begin?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, first, I know in the case of our own child, and I would suspect in the case of most adolescents, they don't know that they have the right to have treatment without parental consent. They usually find that out as was described in some of the testimony Mr. Pritchard mentioned, as they get to a clinic and are told that they don't have to be informed of their parents. So I don't think that children are making decisions about treatment based on whether or not their parents know or don't know. I think that probably doesn't happen. In the case of our own experience, we brought our child to the doctor not on her initiative. We did it because we were concerned. That child had no interest in going to a doctor. And I don't believe that that our child had any awareness that when that examination was completed that we wouldn't be informed. I thought I would have believed that she probably would have expected that we were to be informed. So I don't know that the behavior of adolescents is presumed to be based on the fact that they know they can do things without consent. They find that out, and I think that creates a barrier in the successful, in many cases, successful relationships that need to be built with adolescents and their parents and also the treatment of their health conditions. The other thing, and you mentioned that kids who run away and kids who run away do have reasons, I agree. That doesn't mean those reasons are good reasons. And the presumption that if a kid runs away from home, that that's prima facie evidence that there is a good reason to escape from that home, I don't think that is necessarily valid. There certainly are those circumstances we've tried to provide for them, but in many cases, kids run away from home because they want to be free. They want to do their own thing. They want to, you know, do whatever. We know that. And in that circumstance, I don't know that it does harm, but may, in fact, do good to get parents back involved with their kids' lives. And I'm not living in a dream world. I far from that. This law doesn't pretend at all to correct all the ills that we know exist in our society. But what it does do is try to reestablish the presumption that it is parents who have the best interests of their children at heart in most cases, and that there are exceptions, and let's provide for those as best we can. But let's not presume that all parents of adolescents should be kept out of decisions from their children unless that particular child agrees to let their parents in. That's the thing that we're trying to get at.
Dr. Edwards. Oh, Senator Martin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, you make it sound like kids in runaway kids are trying to get free. I mean, these kids are scared. A lot of them are terrified. It's not easy for a 14, 15, 16-year-old kid to run away from home. They're doing it because they don't think they have an alternative. And they're very scared. Dr. Edwards, if it's Dr. Edwards?
Yes.
If a parent brings in a child to you and says, we're really concerned about it, the example Senator Hand gave, if a child brings them in to you and you, whether it's sexual, reproductive health-related things or mental health or chemical use or something, and you examine the kid and you're in a situation like this, and what happens and how do you talk with the kid about both their situation and about talking with their parents?
Dr. Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty. I think that children present to me in many ways. Most of the time it is with parents, and many times parents have these specific concerns, as you allude to, where they're not quite sure but know that their child needs more medical care. I think to address I mean, we get information from our peers, and teens get information from their peers, so I do think that they are aware that hopefully primary care physicians are another trusted resource if they need a trusted adult and don't have that. But in the case specifically of a child in my exam room, we talk about, have you thought about talking to your parents? Have you talked to them? What are the barriers? How can we talk to your parents? Do you feel safe? How about me being here if you talk to them? I think that our goal is to have an intact support system for a child. And ideally that's parents. But that's unfortunately not always the case. And ultimately we need to create a safe environment and to allow children to know that there are people in the community that are looking out for their well-being. And again, most of the time those are parents, and we need to support families. But the unfortunate reality is many parents struggle themselves and don't have that ability.
And
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Edwards, if there is a situation, you sense the parents are caring and so on, you encourage the child or you tell them, well, do what you choose. I mean,
No, I encourage them
Dr.
to talk.
Edwards.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I definitely encourage them to speak to their parents. In fact, in my recollection, I cannot recall a situation where I had a child come in, we had this discussion, they had their questions answered, and then the next visit, honestly, the parent is sitting with them because we've talked about how to talk to their parents. And I just can't recall a situation where where a child has not done this.
Thank you. Sarah Marty, you made reference before the questioning of these testifiers, questioning the process. And I want you to know that the rules of the Senate were satisfied from the time that this bill was introduced. We gave proper notice. It satisfied the rules. And as far as delete everything amendments, you and I have been here a long time, that an author has the privilege of offering any amendment as a part of an author's amendment, and that too is in the confines of the rules of the Senate. It may not be what you like, but it's definitely within the rules. Senator Marty?
And Mr. Chairman, just so it's clear, I was not accusing you or Senator Hahn of breaking any rules. I'm just saying that the process is better served when, rather than a day when I think most of us have been here long hours for the last several days because of deadlines, which is appropriate. We understand that. But then trying to put this bill in, because, again, this is a bill that normally would be heard in Health and Human Services by the committee jurisdiction. It would have to be heard here, I agree. And, yes, you can make a choice. You want to hear it here first. I'm just suggesting that no rules were violated. I'm not accusing. I'm just saying that I think the process is better served when there's more chance for people to be present and that people actually have a sense. This is a significant changing amendment that I was surprised to see this morning and take some time to digest it. But I just wanted to make it clear. It's not an accusation that somebody broke the rules, just a sense that we can have better discussion of this if people have more of a sense of this coming up.
And Senator Marty, also, it must have happened before you came in. Senator Hahn also informed us that a bill of this nature, of this same subject matter, was discussed in the Health Committee earlier. This bill, however, we took on as primary jurisdiction for the first hearing. And it will go back, if passed, it will go back to the Health Department. We also discussed the court issue as well, probably during your absence.
I think I was here.
The next person would be Senator Latz. He's not at the table. Senator Hoffman, and then Senator Goodman. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the testifier is still here. Dr. Simmons? No, did she leave? Maybe you can answer this question. When you are treating a patient, for whatever you do, you have to get informed consent, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And in my practice, we had to do that too. So I guess I'm not sure what the objection is. And you can't answer the question I had for the other doctor. But my other question was, how long is the blood sample on the card viable? You know, Senator Hahn's amendment has a 2-year provision. I don't know if anybody in the audience can answer that.
Mr. Chair, if I can ask Dr. Susan Berry from the University of Minnesota to speak to that.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
I'm Joanne Bartkus. I'm the director of the Public Health Laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I can address generally how viable the blood spot is. In terms of, it depends on the way it's stored, for one thing. If it's stored frozen, Some components, DNA for one, would be not viable. It's viable means it's living. But it would be intact for some period of time. I couldn't specify exactly how long, but a number of years. A lot of the metabolites, though, that we look at in newborn screening are, these are biochemical tests, as I think has been mentioned, and some of those are not detectable after a certain period of time.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the two-year window of opportunity for to test for the biochemical parts that you would have to find, you know, for the diseases that you're testing for now, is that a long enough time if you have to go back to check for error or, you know, the false positives or the false negatives? Is a two-year window? Is that, I mean, do you still have a good sample in that area?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. What was your last name again?
Bartkus, B-A-R-T-K-U-S.
Ms. Bartkus.
Thank you. In some cases, yes. We don't, not all of our tests are biochemical. The test for cystic fibrosis, for example, or one of the tests for cystic fibrosis is a DNA test. So 2 years, yes, we can go back and do repeat some of those tests, absolutely.
And Sarah Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So after 2 years, what's left of the sample to test?
Ms. Bartkus.
Mr. Chair. Could you clarify, do you mean, are you talking in terms of volume?
No.
Or?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No. What parts of the sample would be available to test? You were talking about the biochemical. They degrade over time. What would be left that you'd be able to perform tests on of the sample? Not the volume, but the integrity.
Mr. Chair. I can't answer that specifically. As has been mentioned, there are probably about 53 different analytes. So to tell you exactly how many, I don't have the expertise to do that. I can get an answer.
Ms. Brace, can you contribute to this discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I was, just to hopefully add some information to this, I was at a conference with a lot of people from around the country. I was asked to speak about our position, and these folks were from health departments around the country. And one of the researchers who was there, who has done a lot of papers, was informing me that the analytes start breaking down after 6 months, and for that reason, Texas had decided they would only keep their specimens for 6 months. This was before they started to keep them forever. But prior to that, they had decided that they would only keep them for 6 months because after that, they thought that their liability was increased because the analytes would break down and they didn't know what kind of information they would have gotten out of that. And perhaps in the same vein, the former head of the CDC laboratory happened to mention to the entire group that some of the group were saying how they would need to keep these specimens for norming laboratory results, et cetera. But he spoke up and he said, you know, you don't need those for any longer than 2 weeks for norming. And that's the extent of it. And everybody there knew him. So I figured he was the expert on that kind of request.
Sir Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I practiced nursing for a number of years, over 20, 25, I lose track. And, you know, I watched hundreds of those heel sticks performed, and until last year I didn't know that we were storing baby DNA, and I was appalled. And I know that a lot of my coworkers are appalled, too, ex-coworkers now, were appalled when I told them about it, too. And the other thing I just want to speak to, I have so many places I could go with this, who would have thought that I was a rebellious teenager and that I might possibly go crosswise with my parents sometime, and I may just decide I want to run away from home because maybe they wouldn't let me have the car because I had broken curfew. Or perhaps my brother was also a rebellious teenager, and he decided to run away from home because he was drinking too much. And my parents decided that wasn't probably the right thing he should do, so he didn't like their rules and he left. And back in those days, doctors and nurses and any other clinician tried to facilitate bringing those families back together. And when I see troubled teens present in the ER, we obviously treat them for their emergent problems, but the very first thing that we do, at least in my practice in the hospitals I've worked with, the very first thing we do is we get those parents in there, because you need to keep those families together. And so I want to thank Senator Hahn for bringing this forward. Both issues, I think these are important. The goal of government should not be to break families apart. It should be to keep them together. And if we continue to break our families apart, these reports are going to get worse. Thank you.
Senator Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, you know, process here, you and I talked about some controversial, potentially controversial legislation, and I certainly think this is one of those things. I'm just wondering why the rush on this meeting. We didn't know until last night that this was going to be on, at least I didn't, maybe it was printed somewhere, but I didn't know we were having a meeting this morning until later yesterday. I didn't know that we were going to have this controversial issue on until later yesterday. And I'm wondering, what's the rush on this? This is the last day, our deadline for fiscal bills, and I understood we weren't going to hear non-fiscal controversial bills before the deadline, or mine was a whole lot less controversial than this and certainly wouldn't have taken this much time. But at any rate, that was my understanding, and so I'm wondering, what is the rush on this? It's a very important issue, and I see points on both sides, but I do think that we need to think about this, and we shouldn't do anything rash here. So maybe you can answer my first question, what is the rush on this?
I'm going to have Senator Hahn answer that question. I'll be able to handle it after if he can't adequately answer it. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Goodwin. We believed in the course of thinking about this legislation that there may be costs to courts or others to make some of the changes that we wish to make, which is one of the reasons why I wanted this to be brought to the Judiciary Committee initially. To review those procedures and to determine if there is cost. We have asked for a fiscal note. We don't know if there will be, but it's possible that there could be, and that is part of the reason. But we also believe that it is a important issue, as you mentioned, and one that is not new to the legislature. I think both of these issues have been before many committees in the legislature in the years that I've been here, and I don't know if they've been before the committees prior to that. So I think it's an appropriate part of the discussion. You're right, the early deadlines this year have concentrated the efforts that we have to make, and certainly if we had the luxury of more time, we might be able to do this in a different way, but I think this is a timely thing, and we would like to have the hearing so that if it is passed through this committee, we could consider it in our bill.
Senator Goodwin?
One other thing. In Anoka County, we have one clinic that does sexual health. They don't do abortions. They don't do anything like that. But what they do have, and this is in upper Anoka County, they have teens, 15, 16, 17, 14, whatever, that come to the clinic because they think they have sexually transmitted diseases or they're trying to figure out what they are. This clinic sits down with the kids and talks to them about what sexually transmitted diseases are, how they can get them. They counsel them and counsel them to talk to their parents about their sexual life and some of these questions. But a number of these young people are not able to ask these questions or talk to their parents about these issues. If your bill passes, that clinic will not be able to see the overwhelming majority of these kids that don't feel comfortable. That concerns me because what they learn in that process is so valuable for not transmitting sexual diseases, and they will not be able to do that without their parents' consent.
Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman, and maybe this is a question for counsel, what happens to a child who is 12 who presents at a clinic for a STD treatment? Are parents informed at age 12?
Ms. Pontius, do you know, or Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chairman, as far as I'm aware, there's not an age distinction in the statute. It applies to all minors.
All minors.
But I haven't looked at
I've heard some reference to something that's like a 13 and older, but I'm not sure where that comes from.
And Mr. Chairman, I had heard that too, and that's why I was asking. I'm not sure. Again, I think that if an adolescent or a young person comes to a clinic or a physician to seek treatment, I think it's perfectly fair for a physician to inform the child that they'd be happy to talk with them. They need to get their parents involved, and I don't think that this precludes the discussion of the physician with the child to encourage that to occur.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Thompson, did you have anything to add to this particular discussion?
No, I probably would go a different direction. So.
We're stacking up our senators wanting to engage in the conversation. I'm going to go to Senator Ingebrigtsen next, followed by Ortman and Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Dr. Edwards could come forward again.
Is there a hand? I'm sorry, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Doctor. One of the comments you had made that stuck out to me was you would have potentially a stepfather or something that would have had sexual intercourse with a child or something like that, and you would certainly want to help them through that. There's certainly laws in place for mandating reporting if there's a crime suspected, and I think those laws are generally working quite well. Do you agree or disagree?
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Edwards.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Yes, mandated reporting is working well. The mandated reporting in that particular situation would assume that the child was actually able to obtain medical care and come to an individual that would be able to do that mandated reporting. Obviously, in the example I gave, the case was reported.
Thank you. And
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Senator Marty has talked, this is the comment, the Senator Marty's talked about running away and why these kids are running away, and it seems kind of interesting that somebody would think that if a child was required to or asked to talk to their parents about sexually transmitted disease or pregnancy or alcohol abuse or drug abuse, and that somebody would use that for an excuse to not tell the parents, and a child would run away if we were to do that. My contention would be that child probably already intended on running away. I can't imagine what I would feel like if I was a medical facility that didn't consult with a parent. Although legally, I guess you don't have to, and the child were to run away, and there were to be a terrible situation where the child ended up being killed or died from exposure, and the parents not even knowing that. You know, we parents and lawmakers and policymakers in the world I used to come from, and here is no different. We always kind of go around circle and come back to one big issue is parenting. And it's a tough job. Nobody's ever taught us how to parent. There's no question about it. But we tell our teachers, take care of this. Take care of this issue. But what do? As soon as they lay a hand on a child, or as soon as they try and stop a disruption that might be interfering with 28 or 29 other people, what do? We say you can't stop that, because I'm going to come with an attorney through the front door of the school district, and I'm going to own them. And so we're really leaving the parents out of the situation here. I mean, in Minnesota, one thing that's required to get, for goodness sakes, we're required to get permission to, for parents have to allow or give permission to kids to have tattoos or body piercing when they're minors. But if they come in with a sexually transmitted disease or they come in with alcohol abuse, the parents are not allowed to be a player in that situation. It's just amazing. I think if the general public were to know that this is going on, and I don't think they do until it actually happens to them, I think they would be, it'd be a real eye-opening experience for them. So I applaud Senator Hand for bringing this forward. I think in the overwhelming amount of cases, the parents, you're going to be way further ahead by getting the parents involved. If we want them involved, we wanted a parent, then we have to be part of the process and not allow this kind of activity to go on without being talked about. So thank you, Mr. Senator Hand, for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. I just realized that Senator Latz was, I remember calling on him when he was out of the room, and we may be off subject, but Senator Latz, why don't we go to you next?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of thoughts. One is that I suspect in a situation that Senator Goodwin had raised about kids going to a clinic and the people at the clinic saying, come back after we bring the parents in the loop, we'll never see the kid again.
Yeah.
The kid probably will not go talk to the parents about it. Instead of getting treatment or help, they'll suffer. I certainly, as a parent of an almost teenager, I certainly sympathize with the desire to be involved in the process, but I'd rather, if my son couldn't talk to me, at least he had a trusted adult he could talk to and get the help he may need. I'm a little bit concerned about the process here. We're talking about asking for a fiscal note. We're in front of a budget committee today. Fiscal note may affect courts. We don't know if it will. If it does, how we're going to handle that. Today is the deadline. We spent a lot of time in this committee dealing with some controversial policy issues that aren't budget related, but now we're up against a budget deadline. We haven't heard from the courts. It would be helpful to hear from a judge talk to us about the judicial bypass process and how it works, whether or not the judges think it's a valuable process. I've got some questions about the language in the bill. There's mention here of minors, but not emancipated minors. So it sounds like, unlike in current law, if someone is 17 years old, they're not living at a residential treatment facility. They're just living on their own. They may be 17 years, 364 days old, living in an apartment, working full-time. And they get pregnant and decide they need care, and they can't get it without bringing their parents in. Let's say they're completely estranged from their parents. I don't see bypass opportunity here unless they got pregnant by their stepdad. But if they didn't, then what do? They're stuck. Let's say they're 17 years old in 1 month and they wouldn't be 18 before a baby, if carried to full term, were born. Then they're really stuck having to make a decision on their own. Either they try to find their parents, which they're unlikely to do, or they go seek an illegal abortion in a back alley, or they take drugs, or they self-inflict, or they don't get prenatal care, which puts the child at risk, especially if the 17-year-old's own lifestyle has those risk factors. Or they're forced to carry a baby to term that they may, for a variety of reasons, be uncomfortable doing. And the state of the law is that they have the option. They ought to have the option if they're 18 to be able to terminate the pregnancy, but if they're 17 and a couple of months old, they don't. There are a lot of 17-year-olds, frankly, who have more life experience than a lot of adults, probably. They won't have a choice because there isn't any judicial bypass process here for them. There's also no judicial bypass process here under certain circumstances for stranger rape. So if you're raped by your stepdad, you can have exceptions in this bill. But if you were raped by a stranger in a park and you got pregnant or got an STD, you don't have a procedure in this bill to give you access to care. That seems to me completely inappropriate. I think this is going to raise all sorts of barriers. Wrong about my analysis of the bill, in terms of the language and the content, I'd sure prefer to be corrected on that. In terms of the consequences, we obviously have some disagreements in general about the consequences. And, of course, we're balancing parental rights and interests here. But I think we got to keep our heads out of the sand here about real life on the streets. I mean, I don't pretend to have a lot of exposure to it myself, but I've certainly listened to a lot of testimony, too. And I think there are a lot more kids will end up being harmed by this. We will see the consequences of that somewhere down the road. But how does the chairman intend to handle the process here? Fiscal note pending. We don't know if it's going to affect the courts. This bill creates a new crime, by the way, and a new civil cause of action, which we should have some discussion about before we pass the Judiciary Committee's imprimatur on to creating a new misdemeanor crime for which a person who violates it could be put in jail for 90 days. Does that judges have judicial immunity? What about others in the court system that might be part of a process that runs afoul of the procedure here? What about clinicians, people at a clinic, medical professionals? They don't have immunities. Do we have any testimony from them about the impact that criminalizing their conduct might have on the process? Do we have any testimony or information on what fiscal impact a new civil cause of action might have? We have testifiers at the table that received notice that this portion was even going to be in the bill. My understanding is that the placeholder language in the Health and Human Services omnibus bill did not include this, the minor consent stuff. That shows up for the first time here in the Weedall Amendment at 7 o'clock in the morning at deadline, when the very subject of this whole content should have had a full-blown hearing in Health and Human Services. That's why I was surprised this was the first committee that this bill has even been heard at. My guess is the bill should have been initially referred to Health and Human Services. I don't know if it was on the floor or not. But I mean, why are we the committee of origination in this? A lot of process questions here. And why we're rushing this through now, I think the question is absolutely right. I mean, if the majority set these deadlines up early for budget purposes, not for policy purposes. And if we're loading up, I mean, this committee has been good about not loading up our budget bill with all sorts of controversial policy questions, and we're going to be dealing with those at some point, I assume, anticipating we'll see some of those. But if other committees are loading up their bills with policy purposes, that's not our problem. They should keep their budget bills clean. So my thoughts, Mr. Chairman, but I wonder if the chairman can answer the questions about process and fiscal impact.
Well, Senator Latz, you may have been out of the room earlier when I addressed the same question from Senator Marty. And at that time, we have satisfied the notice requirements in the Senate. Senator Hahn has had a discussion about this very same issue in Health and Human Services as he was detailing his direction. He wanted us to have that so that this bill, if passed today, would go back to Health and Human Service Committee. We are satisfying the rules of the Senate on this. In matters of misdemeanors, that is not individual misdemeanor considerations. That is not a fiscal concern in our for the purposes of Senate court budget, and it never has been. I know you're new to the committee, but that's the confines and parameters of us. So as far as I'm concerned, it is the intention of this committee to make a decision by the time we're done today. And by session. So I'll move on to Senator Ortman.
Ask a follow-up question first on process, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. No, I heard your comment earlier about that process. I guess I didn't find the answer satisfying for my priorities. I want to know if the fiscal note that's been requested had a local fiscal impact request as well, because if it were legal to drive drunk in Minnesota until today and we proposed to create the misdemeanor crime of DWI, I suspect there'd be a very substantial fiscal impact on the courts and on local jurisdictions that enforce it and prosecute it. So it seems to me just saying the fact that it's a misdemeanor has no fiscal impact would not be accurate. I think we ought to know these answers. And there's still the civil cause of action that's created here as well, and the liability potential for all sorts of individuals involved in the process. I think we need to know something about that before we can make an informed decision about the proposal before us.
Yeah. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've served on this committee for 8 years, and it has extremely broad jurisdiction. It impacts almost every bill. There's some touch with some legal aspect. And I served with Senators Ranum, Senator Betzold, and Senator Moi, who did the exact same thing we're doing today, which was to accommodate big budget bills, we would hear the policy or the judiciary aspects of it before there was a vote on the budget bill. And so I appreciate Senator Limmer bringing this bill and Senator Hand bringing this bill to this committee so we could see that. And so I know that these are tough deadlines, but this is the work of the Senate, and I appreciate your bringing it here so we could look at these provisions. I have four teenagers at home. There are 19, 18, 16, and 13. And I can't tell you how many mixed messages there are for my kids about what they should do, whether they're independent, whether they should be independent, shouldn't be independent, count on mom, don't count on mom. That makes it so hard on them. It makes it really hard on us as parents, trying to reinforce that we are there to support them, because so many of the messages in our society today say we're not. And they have more and more encouragement to venture out into the world, but we want our home and our parenting to be their safe harbor. And I think those mixed messages are making it so much harder on families. And so, Senator Hahn, I appreciate what you're doing today to say at least if you're going to go to a clinic or go see a doctor, somebody's going to call your parent. And so we can get involved. We can help. I don't know who else is going to help those kids. And so they're making very big decisions without the advice of somebody who loves and cares about them. And I think that's a tragedy. So I appreciate very much what you're doing. I am very supportive. There are a couple of things I'd like to comment on. Senator Latz spoke about the 17-year-old and 1 month. But if the 17-year-old is living in an apartment and has a job, that teen already has a remedy. It's emancipation, can already qualify for that and can already take control of their own destiny there. There's also in law already a judicial bypass, so this is not new. There are options for teens that can establish that they are fully capable legally of making these decisions. The two things that I want to bring up, the two specifics here, Senator Hahn, I'm not convinced about the misdemeanor status here. I understand why we would want to have a civil action, but healthcare providers, I'm not sure I want to see law enforcement citing healthcare providers when everyone is trying to help folks. If you're trying to help someone, I would say that might have a fiscal impact. It might not. That's not the basis for my concern. I'm just not sure we want to send that message, but I leave that to you. I'm just going to just comment that I'm not as comfortable with that perhaps as others. The second thing, I have on my resume, Senator Hoffman, rebellious teen. I think that many of us do, and it's maybe not a bad qualification for being a state senator. I sense it, that quality among others as well. I'm looking at you, Senator Ingebretson. It does help to be in the minority, for sure. The other concern I have is when I was a junior high school student, my best friend lived in a foster home, and the foster parents were her parents for all intents and purposes. There was no parental involvement. So I'm concerned with the language on 6.28 because it talks about minors in out-of-home placement, and it says that a foster parent or someone who's managing that out-of-home placement can serve in the place and can help after reasonable efforts have been made to contact the parent. But there's that language on 6.28 that says except for family planning services. And I'm concerned that that would keep that foster parent from helping a young girl or a young boy with some of those decisions. And I want to empower our foster parents and not leave these kids, again, without some authority in their life and some safe harbor for folks that can help them make those decisions. So I'd ask you to consider that language as well. I'm not going to offer an amendment on either of those provisions at this time. I would defer to both the chair and the author here to say those are two pieces here I'm a little concerned about, but I will defer to you on your wishes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. At this time, is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this issue in the audience? Madam, if you could approach the table.
Not on that issue.
Is it addressing the bill?
It's not on minor consent. It's just on the new bill.
That's all right. Please approach the table. I believe that this is Senator Ingebrigtsen's constituent, and so she's obviously traveled a ways, and before we get to the final decision, I'd like to hear from her. Please proceed. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair, members. I actually haven't traveled that far. My name is Anna Marie Saarinen, and some of you actually may know me, and it's just a full disclosure. I'm a registered lobbyist working on environmental issues this session, so maybe knocking on doors for a different purpose, but I'm here wholly as a mother today, and that's why I thought it was so important that you heard at least from one mom today. I know there are many that would have maybe liked to have been here if there was a little bit of extra notice, but you guys are in tight timeline. You're working really hard to get things done, so respectfully to your work that's been done. My youngest daughter was diagnosed at 2 days old with critical congenital heart disease. I haven't talked about this in a while. I'm sorry. She was in three different hospitals in the first 5 days of her life, and ended up going to a fourth hospital for her open heart surgery, her two heart surgeries at 4 months of age. It was during that journey in between when we also realized she had Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, which is an associated genetic anomaly with actually several other genetic anomalies that are even more severe than that one. And when we arrived in Boston for her open heart surgery, there were concerns about whether or not they were fully informed on everything they needed to be with her genetic caseload. And I think had some of the language been in place today, I'm not sure there would be quite as many opportunities to go back and revisit the blood spots and take a look at other disorders associated with congenital heart disease that could greatly impact her outcome. So I have my very real concerns with how we're addressing the blood spots and the storage. I know this impacts so many children. When you're a pregnant mother, you're living in this realm of bliss. This was my third child. My oldest is a freshman in high school. I was told by all of my daughter's doctors that if she had been born when my son was born 15 years ago, she would not be alive. So medicine does wonderful things. 15 years in medicine is a lifetime in a lot of other areas that we know. And it's because of research and advancements and care for these rare diseases and disorders. I had no idea that one in 100 babies are born with congenital heart disease. Who does? Who knows that until you're touched by it? Who knows that 1 in 1,000 have Wolff-Parkinson-White or 1 in 30 or 40,000 have Pompe disorder? These are all things that you don't think about. And so with due respect to this notion that parents know best for their kids and are always having the best interest in heart, of course we all do. But if you don't know before your child is born and you have these critical diagnoses come up, and you're just literally living hour by hour trying to get your child to the next day, you can't think about all these other things that might be incredibly relevant 1 month down the road, 4 months down the road, or potentially 2 years down the road. Who knows? So I won't speak to the legalities of
of how things play out within the newborn screening program, but I will tell you that in my 2 years since, working with physicians and working at the federal level with the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children, that state Department of Health workers, they are committed and their hearts are in the right place with these newborn screening programs. Are there things that can be looked at and can be fixed? Absolutely. I primarily work in health IT in Washington, D.C., and there are mechanisms right now to embed informed consent into electronic health records so parents will have more simple options to understand these things as they're in the hospital at the point of care. You're right, nobody wants to look through three sheets of paper when they just gave birth to a baby. But it's going to be kind of just as hard to understand the opt-in as it is to understand the opt-out. Someone might argue you're going to lose people on either side of the equation. My last thing for you, because I'm a mother and I can. You're all here. That's 5 days after open heart surgery.
Wow.
It is amazing what medicine can do. We are grateful every single day for the opportunity we were given. She's 2 years old. Thank you for your commitment to these issues, your consideration. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman.
Pardon me? Oh, Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I want to thank, I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, but I appreciate your testimony, and I'm happy to hear that your daughter with a congenital heart birth defect has made progress. We also had a son who was born with a congenital heart defect and unfortunately was not a survivor of that and the surgery that was required. And so I am very sympathetic and actually very happy for you that your child has had a better outcome than ours did. However, what we're trying to do is not to prevent parents from participating in screening or testing. We want that to occur with informed consent. That is the difference. I think that the arguments that are being made that say this is a good thing to do, I'm not saying one way or the other. I think that is a decision that parents need to make, but they need to make it. And the presumption ought to be that's a parental decision, not the decision of a government to say we should do this and provide a mechanism that, as we've heard testimony, as I've understood from having experienced the birth of our granddaughter, and I asked our daughter at the time, did anybody tell you about all this? And the answer, of course, is no. And they may have gotten the pamphlet or the other information. But I think it is important that we establish the principle that decisions about our health and about testing of our DNA and other tissues ought to be done in an informed way, not a presumption, and then give people a chance, if they know, to opt out of it.
Thank you. Members, I directed the committee that we would be making a decision by the end of this meeting. We are soon to be in session at this time. Senator Newman renews his motion that Senate file number 1017, as amended, be recommended to pass and be directed to the Health and Human Service Committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I just a couple of sentences here. I think government should never tear families apart. That's not what we can be about. But we can't force families to be whole. We can't force families to be healthy. We can only foster policies that help all family members, from our oldest to our youngest, help all our family members to be as healthy as they can be. At the end of the day today, at the end of passing this bill and moving it forward, I believe is going to cost us in lives. I don't want to be overly dramatic about that. I think some teens will not seek help because the word is out there. They certainly know how to communicate. They'll know that their parents have to be brought into those discussions. Troubled teens, and then infants who haven't even been born yet, who are affected by the testing that will be done and the research that's done. Infants who haven't even been born yet may not survive if those tests aren't able to be done as broadly as they need to be. So, Senator Hahn, I respectfully just reject your bill.
Senator Marty, a brief comment,
please. Mr. Chairman, yes. Senator Ingebrigtsen, when you mentioned the tattoo thing, I was a co-author of that, and there's a reason for that, because we do want parents involved in every way in their child's life. The reason for that is, barring that procedure, the kid is healthy. That procedure actually has some risk and other things to it, and we want parents to be involved in these other cases. The difficulty is that if they don't get the help, they're at risk. And when you say, oh, yeah, if you think a kid did, well, they just use this as an excuse to run away. I think we all got this from just this last week. It has nothing to do with this particular issue. It deals with homelessness. It talks about a kid who, because of family violence, ran away and would come back home, stayed with an uncle, came back home. New stepfather does this, new this happens. It's a multi-stage, and kids do want to go to their parents, but in the end ends up running away. And I think that this is very simplistic to suggest that either kids run away because they want to be free, not because they're hurting and not because they're scared. But that's the reality, and the reality is that kids aren't going to get the help they need. If we had more time, I would have loved to ask for somebody to talk about the sexual assault and other things and how this impacts reporting for that, because, again, these are people who are in – these are at-risk things. It's not like the kid is totally healthy and then they got this one little thing. Most cases, they've got multiple problems, sometimes multiple ones with their parents. And I think this bill is a dramatic move backwards in terms of public health and well-being of kids. And I do want parents to be involved, but the difficulty is here. If the parental involvement is going to hurt the child, we shouldn't be doing that. And I think that's what we're doing here.
Mr. Chairman, I request a roll call.
Roll call
the
will
results
be
printed in the journal.
Chair. Three hands. There will be a roll call with the record as recorded. The motion is before us. Senator Nunes' motion, Senate Bill 1017, be recommended to pass as amended and be directed back to the Health and Human Service Committee. All those in – please proceed with the roll call.
Senator Thompson.
Yes.
Senator Hall.
Yes.
Senator Goodwin.
No.
Senator Marty.
No.
Senator Jungbauer.
Yes.
Senator Ortman.
Yes.
Senator Latz.
No.
Senator Newman.
Yes.
Senator Limmer.
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes.
Senator Scheid.
No.
Senator Harrington.
No.
The motion passes 8-5. And the motion prevails. There's no other business before the committee. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.